Hi, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Stacey.
And this is the Body Smart Podcast.
Now, I just want you to stop whatever you're doing right now and notice how you're breathing. Because you take around 20,000 breaths per day and you probably don't even notice it. It just happens. You probably never even stopped to think, how am I breathing? But how you're breathing actually has a huge, massive knock-on impact to your health, your mental state, your stress levels, your sleep. So much more. Hence why we have our wonderful guest today, Jamie Clements. Hello, Jamie.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me, guys.
Amazing to have you. So Jamie is a breathwork coach and facilitator. It's a difficult word to say. With a London studio, and you also run international retreats. Is that right? You've got stories in various respected press outlets and basically a bit of a guru when it comes to why we should be paying attention to our breath and what you can do to help reap the benefits of that. So, what we love about you, though, is it's not all woo-woo. When I said guru, rhymes. When I said guru, people might be thinking you're like some kind of white, floaty, kind of hippie guy. Definitely down to earth, kind of the same approach as Jamie and myself, where you want to know the science, you want to explain it in very real terms and give people practical things they can do in real life. That's why we thought, great guest for the podcast. So I want to start with the fact that the majority of people in our modern lives just are not breathing properly. Can you talk about why that is and what the problems are that leads to?
Yeah, and thank you for the lovely introduction. I'm glad I left my flowy white robes at home today. So as you mentioned in that intro, you know, we're taking 20 plus, most of us 23 to 25,000 breaths every single day as an adult. And that number is rising with some of the challenges and issues that we're seeing with stress and anxiety and dysfunctional breathing. And at the core of this is that little term and bit of jargon that I use there, which is dysfunctional breathing. Now, depending on who you ask and where you research and what you look at, the stats that we throw around for dysfunctional breathing and the population varies pretty massively from anywhere from 35% all the way through to some people claiming 99%.
99%.
Now, yeah, that was on a large podcast where they like to make big claims. And I think what that figure, when we talk about 99%, what that person is actually referring to is really the fact that there might be, let's say, 30, 40, 50% of the population who fall into diagnosable dysfunctional breathing. And we can talk more about what that actually means. But the rest of us could be breathing better. Mm-hmm. And it really comes down to this fact that we're just not paying enough attention to it. For me, breath is this forgotten pillar of health that is so integral to all of our functioning, how we feel, how we think, how we experience life. And it's this unfortunate case of it being so simple that we think it's too simple to matter. We go, oh, it's so simple, it doesn't matter. And the reasons that this has grown and developed, particularly in the Western world, are due to rising levels of stress, poor diet, or exercise. In some cases, dysfunctional breathing shows up as a result of trauma, but really just, again, not paying attention to it. And as our nervous systems become more stimulated, more activated, we fall into these typical kind of telltale signs of dysfunctional breathing. So it's something that I think weirdly COVID brought to the surface a lot more. There was a lot of attention being paid to breath work really in the lead up to it. But then with everybody pausing and stopping, but also COVID being a respiratory disease, a respiratory illness, making people short of breath was one of the key symptoms, right? People all of a sudden were paying attention to how important their breath is, or certainly noticing the importance of it when it is taken away from them. It's multifaceted, as with everything, but I think as we begin to pay more attention to how we breathe, we realize, yes, the simplicity of it, but also the impact of it. And I think that's why more people are kind of starting to wake up to this as well.
Could you explain then a little bit more, like, what is dysfunctional breathing? It sounds like, from what you said there, there's like layers to it. Could you get into like more detail around that, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think to define it, really, as we've sort of spoken to already, it just refers to any form of breathing that is suboptimal for your physical health, your mental health, your emotional health. So what does that look like? There are some pretty...
What's optimal then? What is like, because I guess we're working backwards through it. So like, what's like the most optimal way to breathe? And then is that the best way you would go about it?
We'll start with the bad news, okay, and then we can come to the,
we'll come to the good solution. Yeah.
So I think from a dysfunctional standpoint, what we're really looking at typically will be mouth breathing, fast, shallow upper chest breathing. And some people roll their eyes at this term, but it's valid over breathing, which is just breathing beyond what your body requires. We actually breathe too much in the same way we can eat too much. And that can have negative implications as well. Frequent sighing, frequent yawning. And then also there's a lot of chat around dysfunctional breathing during sleep at the moment, which is where people are starting to talk about things like mouth taping. And the telltale signs from that side of things are things like dry mouth, fatigue, brain fog, and all of those can feed into daytime symptoms as well. But I'd say at its core, it tends to be breathing too quickly, breathing at too high a volume, breathing loudly, breathing through the mouth, and breathing into that upper chest area. Those are pretty much the kind of classic signs of dysfunctional breathing.
And how would someone know if they are a mouth breather versus a nose breather? Is there a way of knowing?
It really comes back to this idea of start paying attention. The fact that breathing can be automatic and unconscious is important because we do it so many times a day, but it also means that we can pay absolutely no attention to it. And so I think for the vast majority, and I always try and make this kind of as broad and as practical as I can, is actually the first step is always just starting to pay attention. Right. So day to day, moment to moment. And this, when we start to get into the realms of talking about what does functional breathing look like, that's the first step, is as you go about your day, when you're at your laptop, when you're walking, when you're on the tube, on the train, whatever it might be, just checking in with it, going, oh, am I breathing? You know, how am I breathing? And also, how do I feel within that? So you'll also have, an old friend of mine who I used to live with was, and this was before I got into this work, an awful mouth breather. You know, you could hear him breathing. Ultimately at rest, you shouldn't really be able to hear your own breath. And someone next to you certainly shouldn't be able to hear it. And so people will also let you know as well, I think, but it's mostly about getting that awareness yourself and starting just to check in and take stock of how you're breathing at different points throughout the day as well, because your breath will change and fluctuate throughout the day.
So what are the negatives? You know what I mean? We're saying like, oh, you should, you know, people need to predominantly be nose breathing. That's right. Not mouth breathing.
Yeah.
Like why? You know, if I'm listening to this, I'm like, I'm breathing. I'm alive. Like why should I do this?
Yeah. I think that's the classic response, right? Is, you know, I remember I turned up to a venue in Bristol for an event and I said to the security guard, I was like, I'm here for the breathwork event. And he looked at me, what I thought was very genuinely, and went, oh, I love breathwork. I really love it. And I'm like, oh, really? He's like, yeah, I've been breathing my whole life. I don't know how many times I've heard that.
Yeah.
But it did get me. But I think that is the classic bit of pushback, is going, why should I pay attention to it? I can do it with my eyes closed. I can do it without thinking about it. And there's validity in that. But the importance of it is now so well studied that it's getting harder and harder to ignore. So some of the, I suppose, the negative implications of dysfunctional breathing will be things like poor sleep, poor cognitive function. We actually, when we breathe, get into that over-breathing sort of hyperventilatory type state where we're breathing beyond our body's requirements, we're reducing oxygenation of the brain. So we can get brain fog, we can get fatigue, we can get impaired cognitive function, impaired memory. It can impact circulation, it can impact blood pressure. It can really impact so many aspects of our functioning. It is so core to our overall functioning that it can also positively and negatively impact depending on how it's playing out. But I think one of the biggest pieces of the puzzle is the impact and the influence that it has on the state of your nervous system and stress levels. So if we are breathing really quickly into that upper chest region, then we're going to actually be creating a stress response within the nervous system. So if you are just sat, again, we take the example of sat at your desk, at your laptop, and you're breathing really quickly, you're creating stress on your system without any stress happening around you. And so your experience of life is going to be in that elevated, sort of stressed, activated state.
And it's important to say that that's not just about, oh, it feels stressful. Having your body in an elevated stress state for any long period of time is not what it's designed to be. And there are longer term implications of that, right?
Big time. So it's one of the biggest challenges we face, I think, as a society at the moment, is this chronic stress and burnout. And high anxiety experience of life. You know, people are burning the candle at both ends. They are pushing. And then they get home and they sit on the sofa and they're breathing fast and they're breathing shallow. and they're creating more stress on their system. They're continuing to produce adrenaline, cortisol, stress hormones, and then they wonder why they wake up four times a night and don't have good sleep. And then they're tired in the morning. Then they make poor decisions. Then they're more stressed. Then their diet goes to crap. And then it just perpetuates and perpetuates. And there have to be ways to interrupt that cycle. And the breath, because of its simplicity, is one of the most effective ways to interrupt that cycle and start taking back control over that experience.
So if that is me, or if that's someone listening and they're going through that sort of situation of, this does sound like me, I do feel like I maybe breathe fast, I get really anxious, you know, I'm coming home from work, I'm thinking about all the problems in work, I'm going to go into the house, there's going to be other issues there. Like, have you got any strategies that you would give to someone to maybe help, like, calm? Because I know I've done a little bit of box breathing before, not too much. And a big one I've done just sometimes is just the two big inhales through the nose and a long exhale. And I always find if I just do like a 4 second inhale and an 8 second exhale, I just, like, I've done it when I've been measuring my blood pressure. My heart rate can go from like 70, 80s to like 50s off just doing a minute or two of breathing, which isn't, I feel like, it's 30 beats a minute. it's quite a lot.
Yeah, it's significant. And I think this is the other thing is that, you know, I would encourage most people, if they're looking to kind of get into this stuff, 10 minutes a day is a fantastic starting point. But exactly as you've said, a minute, you're seeing an effect. I got back from a public speaking gig back end of last year, and I got back in my flat and I was feeling a bit antsy, a bit agitated. I was like riding quite high. I was quite excited. I was pretty happy with it. And I checked my heart rate, my resting heart rate, and I was ticking at like 95. I sat on the sofa just ticking over, and I was like, all right, let's kind of put my money where my mouth is. And I got the real-time heart rate tracker on my Whoop up, and I was like, I'm going to do 1 minute, close my eyes, of extended exhale breathing, 4 seconds in, 8 to 10 seconds out. And I went from 95 to 52 in 60 seconds. Yeah. And I was like, I was even a bit taken aback. I was like, oh yeah, there's a really nice reminder for me of just how powerful this stuff is. And so I think all of the stuff you've spoken to there, Jamie, is a fantastic place to start for people. Sort of begin, as we've spoken to already, with that awareness. Actually, to be aware that you are breathing more quickly is the first step. And then from there, we want to be focusing on breathing deeply, breathing slowly. And if you can then build into that, extending the exhale. So from a heart rate perspective and a heart rate variability perspective, when we inhale, our heart rate slightly speeds up. When we exhale, our heart rate slightly slows down. So the logic would suggest that if we make our exhale longer than our inhale, heart rate's just going to keep coming down. Your whole system's going to start to relax, and we're going to move into that really nice balanced, relaxed state. So breathing through the nose, breathing light, breathing slow, breathing deep, working with the diaphragm, working with a really nice, deep, expansive breath, because this is one of the big things that we see from a breathing dysfunction perspective is people breathing shallow, but also people breathing vertically. The number of people that you say take a deep breath and they go, yeah, and it's all coming straight up into their chest. You don't see any animal do that. You don't see a baby do that. You know, it's fully expansion through belly, side ribs, lower back. If you cut somebody off on the camera, for example, from the chest up, you'd probably see very, very little movement if they were taking a deep breath, if they were doing it in that sort of optimal functional way. But I think for the majority of us, not from anyone's fault, but I always remember growing up and the advice being, if you're panicking, take a deep breath. And I'm like, oh, what does that mean? And they go,
yeah. And it's so unhelpful because when you're panicking, breathing in is super hard. And as you've described, it's the exhale, which is more important. It's also more accessible for a lot of people. So I think one of the things that I was just saying to Jamie about line breath, if you familiar.
I literally thought you were taking the piss.
To be fair, it's the one I use the most with kids.
I'm not going to do a demo with a mic here because everybody will have to take their headphones out. But basically, it's like you just get everything out. And it's almost like a reset, isn't it? And I think for me, a lot of breath practices, if you focus on the exhale, it's like you just reset the pattern a bit, and then it's easier to take deep breaths in because you aren't stuck in this like trapped mode.
And I think it's one of the big ones. So my journey into this work started from severe anxiety and panic attacks, and one thing that I get increasingly frustrated with from people in my field is giving very kind of what sounds like straightforward helpful advice of, if you're having a panic attack, breathe in for 8 seconds and out for 16 seconds. And if you're having a panic attack, you're going, how on earth, like, do you expect me to even get close to that? I can hardly catch my breath. Mm-hmm. And so I do think there's a caveat, and quite an important caveat, to say, in moments where you can't catch your breath, actually your best friend, yes, is the exhale if you can get there, but before that can actually be really short breath holds. Mm-hmm. And that just actually helps you to maintain or regain control over the breath. Mm-hmm. And so if you do find yourself actually falling into a state where breathing slowly or catching your breath is really hard, something like a very short-sided box breath of in for two, hold for two, out for two, hold for two, something like that can be a great way just to regain that control. And then from there, you can start to take back kind of those slower, deeper breaths, working with the exhale. And so there's a need for nuance in this stuff, and there's a need for understanding of meeting someone where they're at as well, I think.
Is that one of the main reasons that you've got into this line of work, because of yourself and maybe what you were struggling with?
100%. Like, yeah. It's the reason, ultimately. Probably from about the age of 15 through to 24, 25, had various challenges with my mental health. I was high functioning. It was all sort of going on behind the scenes. But in my early 20s, started having panic attacks. They became increasingly regular. And then I just sort of hit a bit of a few breaking points over my early 20s, but one particular breaking point where I just knew that something had to shift and had to change. And breathwork was a huge part of that. Wasn't the only part of that, but it was the linchpin that kind of brought it all together. And, mm-hmm. and from an anxiety perspective, massively helped me take back a level of autonomy and control over life that I needed at that point.
And is that what you felt like was missing? There was maybe a lack of control, like almost like a spiral into chaos, and that's what was causing the anxiety?
100%. I think I just felt like such a passenger to my thoughts and to my triggers and to everything that was going on around me. I was just sort of, something would happen and I'd be having a panic attack, and the gap between those two seemed like nothing, when actually there were a load of opportunities within that to breathe, to pause, to create some separation. Mm-hmm. But when you're in it with no tools and no skills, you're left to it, and it just all spirals from there.
Yeah. So. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And at the time, what were you doing? So I know you were a professional rugby player for a while.
Not quite professional. I was playing semi-professional rugby, and that
semi?
Was...
Semi? Just to stitch the semi?
I know. So I played rugby for a long time growing up. Sports continues to be a huge part of my life. And I'm really grateful for that side of my life, because it taught me a lot about discipline and drive and a lot of stuff that serves me today. I've got a degree in economics, and started working in finance and then financial technology and startups. So I spent about 5-6 years in that world. And similarly through that period, was just struggling a lot under the surface. And I think a lot of it came down actually to just not feeling like myself. I was so disconnected from what I really wanted from life. Mm. And I think growing up, through my teens and early 20s, I was very much geared towards self-abandoning and just like doing what I thought I should be doing, like jumping through the hoops. Even to a certain extent towards the end of my rugby career, I was doing it because I felt like I had to keep doing it. Yeah. And I should be doing it. And I just got myself into a real state as a result. And I think a lot of the last 6-7 years of my life have been reclaiming that autonomy, authenticity, sense of self, refinding that as well. And breathwork, I'm fortunate, was sort of the route into that, and then has also been kind of the continued evolution of that as well.
Yeah. No.
So how did you even discover it though? Because in that space you were describing, it doesn't seem like the kind of thing that would be part of the group.
Yeah, it was a shout out my mum, I suppose. I was in a really dark patch, and we've always been super, super close, and she gently sort of pushed me towards getting some help, and that really opened things up for me and just opened me up to an acknowledgement of the fact that I needed help and that I needed to do things differently if I wanted things to be different. And I'd lost touch with exercise, I'd lost touch with training, got myself back into training, started practicing yoga, and really I sort of started ticking off the list of all of the things that someone might suggest if you were struggling with your mental health. And these things have become a little bit cliche, but they're cliche because they work. And so started trying meditation, started trying yoga, and then found my way through a studio that I was training and practicing at the time to a breathwork session. And that really was the beginning of the journey that's led me here.
How do you How open were you to it? Because I know
I'm
I've got to see it to believe it to an extent. And if you'd told me about breathwork a couple of years ago, I probably would have just like shunned you away in the, or anyone in the sense of, what's that like?
Yeah.
It's just breathing, isn't it? Like, what's it going to do? Like, I need to like take action. Like, it's going to be something more like actionable than breathing to just fix a problem in essence. And even still, you know, like you were saying then, like you were young, you're about early 20s to an extent, like were you open to the concept of breathwork and why? What was that because of your mum? Was that because of somebody else? Was there an influence? Because there's so many other things, like you mentioned, like meditation or exercise or therapy or counseling. Like, there's so many different things that you can try. And they all work and have the place as well.
Yeah.
But why specifically breath work?
I think it was a combination of genuine desperation, of like, I'll try anything at this point. I certainly wasn't as open-minded as I am now, nowhere near as open-minded as I am now. And then also a guy called Christian, who was running the studio at the time, who's actually now a business partner of mine in a separate venture. He just suggested it, just very gently. He was an ex-professional rugby player, someone that I really respected and still do respect. And he suggested it and I went, okay, like maybe if he's saying there's something to it, I'll give it a try. And exactly to your point, Jamie, like it was, and this is what I love about breathwork so much, is that it's undeniable when you get in the room. And like I very much view my job, and these conversations are a great place for that, as trying to get people in the room. People who perhaps typically wouldn't be in the room. If you can get them in the room, there's a good chance that they're going to go, oh, okay, I get it now. Because the experience for me was, it was very felt. And if you feel something in the body, if you feel something going on and shifting and changing, feel your state change, then there's no argument anymore. Yeah. There's no debate. I'm like, cool, I'm in. This works. This makes a difference. And that's really what has stayed with me, is actually, and it's, you know, there is still in certain realms this woo-woo association with breathwork. And there's this kind of full spectrum of different ways that you can use the breath, right the way through from the functional all the way through to big, quite spiritual, transcendent type experiences that you can have with breathwork. And I very much view my mission and my role within that to actually open up all of it to everyone, because that deeper end of the spectrum shouldn't be confined just to the people who are in the robes and the people who do associate with spirituality, because actually there's so much healing, there's so much growth to be found in all of it. And I think it's really important that we don't cut people out as a, you know, intentionally or otherwise.
Mm. I know you mentioned there about it like being fantastic for changing your state, and that's definitely something, you know, I've used, whether it's, I typically find like the drive home from work sometimes, if I am in a very high amped up like state, and I'm like, right, I don't want to take that into the house. I want to bring a different state in. So just like actually being, like you said, bringing it back to the self and being aware that I'm in this state, doing some, you know, box breathing or different types of breathing as I get home, and really trying to have my mindset of like, right, I'm not taking that energy into the house, as being like a real game changer for me.
Yeah.
I know a lot of our clients can struggle with emotional eating. And if we were to look at what the core of what's happening with emotional eating is, you are trying to change your state. Yeah. So you feel uncomfortable, and your sort of current behavior at the moment, or pattern of behaviors, has been, when I feel this state, I want to change the state, I turn to food, highly palatable food that's really pleasurable. And in that moment, it changes my state. I get to like scoff my face with 1,000 calories of chocolate, and I change my state. The problem,
and it often does calm you down.
Yeah, it does, because you're probably being more present in what you're doing, and you're having present with the flavor and the taste and everything else. And it might go on for 5, 10, 50, however long it can go on for people in that moment. But, you know, the problem with that is afterwards comes the guilt and the shame of the extra calories, and then the sugar high, and then the sugar crash. But I do actually feel like breathwork could be like a really helpful technique in that time, or strategy.
100%. And I think to your example of, you know, wanting to leave that state in the car or at work or whatever it might be, like, how powerful is that, right? To actually be able to have a say in that, rather than being like, I've had a rubbish day at work, I'm feeling pissed off, I'm going to go home and I'm going to take it out on everybody else.
Yeah.
Because that is just autopilot. That's how it would play out, until you actually go, it doesn't have to be like that, and I don't want it to be like that. And I think that's the big piece as well that ties into something like emotional eating, is there is desire there for it to not be that way in terms of the behavior, which is where the guilt and the shame come from afterwards, because you're going, oh, I wish I hadn't done that, or why did I do that? And I think where breath fits into this puzzle is creating that space between either the reaction or the response, because we won't ever in our lives remove all discomfort and all triggers, but what we can change is how we respond to those in the moment. And the breath is such a powerful, accessible, immediate way to work with that and go, actually, okay, you know, what is the discomfort that is driving that behavior? That might be an argument with somebody, it might be seeing something on social media, you know, whatever the trigger point is, can I in that moment feel the discomfort because it's there, allow it to be there, really go, okay, I can see that for what it is. And in that moment, take a minute, take 2 minutes to slow your breath and just take yourself out of that impulsive reaction, that instantaneous reaction where you're going on autopilot. And that I talk so much in my work at the moment around how do we take people off autopilot, because that's where the power is. You feel empowered, you feel powerful, you feel in control when you're off autopilot, and actually interrupting those immediate impulsive behaviors is the best way to do that. And that being said, you know, I think often in this conversation around healing, around growth, around personal development, we can be very quick to aim for perfection and then resent ourselves when it doesn't show up and when we fail or when we fall short. And so actually after the fact, let's say you do eat the thing and then feel guilt afterwards, you can self-soothe and self-regulate through the breath after that as well. So the intensity of that negative or challenging feeling isn't quite so strong. Mm-hmm. And so it's really just using the breath as an anchor, a bit of a safety blanket to go, okay, in this moment, is this a behavior that aligns with the version of me that I want to be? If not, can I breathe my way through it? Can I actually take 2 minutes to regulate in the face of the discomfort that's driving this behavior? And if not, can I be accepting of that and breathe my way through the discomfort that comes up after the fact?
Yeah, you've got to really be open to growth to even think like this, because I think it's, you know, we talk about like a diet in a lot of sense. It's, you know, somebody gets to a quote unquote breaking point, and then they've overeaten something on the diet, and then at that point, it's just like, fuck it. You know, like, what's the point? I'm done. I'm off my diet. And the reason that becomes so simplistic is it's one decision. So it's one decision to go, I give up. No more. Done. Like, I'm just going back to old habits and behaviors. I don't care anymore. Versus, like, to be in that moment and then to have that situation happen and have, like, maybe overeaten or emotionally ate or something's happened. Then afterwards to, like, sit in that and explore that and try and understand and be like, right, why did I make that decision? Why did I overeat? Was I not prepared? Am I too stressed? Am I breathing correctly? Yeah. You know, and asking all those questions, it's a lot of, it's like decision fatigue to an extent. You know, it's where planning and preparing becomes so important for some of these side of things. But yeah, like how...
I guess the question I have on it is, do you feel like the breath is effective as a standalone, or does it need that thought process alongside for it to really be effective as well?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think everything has a level of needing to be a multifaceted approach. But what I would say from that perspective as well is that breath is great as a tool for a reactive in the moment intervention. You know, you feel a strong trigger and that stressor hits and you want to take the edge off it. Great. Really good from that perspective. But actually, can we use it more also as a proactive tool so that I'm working on a consistent daily practice, regardless of how I'm feeling, that over time brings my nervous system back to a greater state of balance and regulation, which then means actually I can make better decisions. I'm more attuned to what I actually want. I'm not as reactive in the first place, so I don't have to regulate that as readily and as often, because overall you're kind of operating from a greater state of balance.
Yeah, and I think that's hugely important.
Yeah, and I think that's the bit we kind of underestimate because it's slightly more subtle, because, you know, you might wake up one morning, you might be doing a morning breathwork practice and you go, I feel all right today, I'll leave it. And then 4 o'clock hits and you're, you know, shouting at your partner or you're binging or whatever it might be. And you wonder why. And it's actually because you've not stayed with that consistency. And so I do think that's an important piece, is being proactive and consistent and regular with this stuff. And also, yeah, when it comes to these tools for working with the nervous system, we often talk about bottom up, which is working with the body to affect the mind. So something like your breath. or top down, which is where we're working in the realm of the thoughts and the mind. And I do think at the moment on social media in particular, we are so quick to go bottom up or nothing, top down's rubbish, talk therapy's rubbish. That's rubbish, because actually it has to be both. It has to be both, and different things will work for different people.
But you can choose your way in, right?
100%.
Depending on what suits you, what suits the moment. It doesn't mean you have to be able to be skilled at both to start.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's really key. And I think the piece that I always come back to is actually, if you're not, let's say you love breath work and actually really you connect with it really well, and it's fitting in with how you feel, it's helping you, supporting you. It's very challenging to completely rewire a negative pattern if you're not paying any attention to the underlying beliefs and the core beliefs and the thought patterns behind it. Because the biggest thing I see with a lot of my clients is that the breath work works, but they feel guilty when they rest. They feel guilty when they take a break. They feel guilty when they slow down. And so they just speed back up again.
Could you explain that more? Like when you say in there, they feel guilty around like doing like what exactly?
I think the one of the biggest challenges in a world that is so geared towards high intensity and high stress and people moving very quickly, being productive, you know, hustle culture, is that we spend very little time sitting still. We spend very little time resting, partly because we busy ourselves, but partly because actually for a lot of people who are operating from that activated nervous system state, that state of stress, stillness is uncomfortable. And so a little bit like we were talking about before we came on air, the people who move very quickly in their work and in their life will reach for the HIIT workout, they'll reach for climbing the mountain, they'll reach for the ice bath, they'll reach for more stimulation, they'll go for the next thing that actually adds more fuel to the fire, rather than what they actually need to perform at their best, which is balancing the scales or going, I can still do all of this high intensity work and training and everything else, but they can also rest. And one of the biggest challenges is that a lot of people who do spend their time on that kind of hamster wheel of moving very quickly, it's driven by, not for everybody, and I don't want to generalize, but very often it's driven by a sense of needing to prove themselves or needing to achieve or validate themselves.
Stacey's looking at me. I mean, you're basically like listing my sort of life story at the moment, which is like I do struggle to sit still. I haven't clinically been diagnosed with ADHD, but I started doing counseling last year. And after many, many sessions, she very much come to the diagnosis and talked me through a lot of different things. And I was like, okay, yeah, it kind of makes sense in a lot of ways. But that sort of like high performance, always want to be busy, always want to be doing something. Done the cold baths, done the cold showers. Even recently I've found out I've got like possibly... like pre-hypertension, so like my blood pressure is probably just a little bit higher than it should be, and I'm trying to deal with that. And the way I'm trying to deal with this, I'm instantly like, the guy gave me some advice, so the cardiologist was like, yeah, do some HIIT workouts, do some beetroot, do some other stuff. And I kind of know it's the stress that I'm carrying through the day and I'm holding on to. I can feel it in my chest at times, and even still I'm like, hey, should I buy a sauna? You know, I'm just like, how can I do more? Because I'm like, oh, the heat dump.
We need
really
to find
good.
A way to make rest competitive for Jamie. Okay.
Well, this is it. I love the memes that do the rounds on Instagram, right? Around like, you know, how can I make my rest productive? How can I be most productive in my rest? I'm guilty of this too. Like, I'm naturally wired the same way as you.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And like, I have to work very hard to encourage the rest, because actually it's not, and this is where I think people need to give themselves a level of, cut themselves a little bit of slack, is actually the conditions that we live in are geared towards a wiring that takes you in that direction.
And everything we hear, everything on social media, everything in our friendship groups is everybody's doing all the things. So if I'm not doing all the things, then I'm going to fall up short or, you know, everyone's going to judge me.
100%. And I think that's why meditation is an interesting topic here, because typically, you know, someone sat in your position, my position, we might say, build a meditation practice. And you go, okay, I think I know what that is. I'm going to sit for 10, 15 minutes and it's going to be really uncomfortable because actually that stillness is just bringing up all of the fidgeting, all of the stress, all of the things that I actually have been moving to avoid feeling. And so that happens, you go, I'm not doing that. And that's why, you know, I actually love meditation as a practice, and I'm not here to bash it, but that's why I think breathwork is getting the traction it's getting, because it is more directive. It's more direct in terms of input and outcome. Mm. And so I'm going, okay, I want you to breathe in this certain way, box breathing, extended exhale breathing, the physiological sigh, whatever it might be. And that's going to actually, regardless of what's going on up here, create the state change that we're looking for, which then actually makes something like meditation much more achievable. Yeah. Because nobody who's in an elevated, activated state is going to feel comfortable sitting still. Yeah. They're not going to be able to find peace and quiet in their mind. So actually, breathwork as a gateway into stillness is a really powerful thing. Yeah. And also, it fits with the Western psyche. It fits with the male psyche of people going, okay, I'm being told to do this and it's going to make me feel like this. And that is well documented in the research and in the physiology of it. We actually know that that will create that. And so if you can accept that, acknowledge that, and build that in, we start to move more towards that place of balance, which then makes the rest more comfortable. And when the rest becomes more comfortable, we get greater balance. And so we just start to tip the scales back in our favor in that kind of state of regulation. And the ADHD piece is clearly massive at the moment. And so much of, you know, that first generation to grow up with smartphones and the lifestyle factors of stress and social media and everything else are creating this wave of people really struggling. And ultimately, it's an expression of the nervous system in this very chronically activated state. And we know from the research now that Huberman's done and that others have done in this space that the most simple and effective way into that is through the breath.
Breathing, yeah.
The other thing that I think is key for people who have got very busy minds is you're doing something when you're doing breath work. Whereas when you're asked to meditate, a lot of the time you're just doing nothing. You're passive.
Yeah.
And so it can feel very hard when you're the person who's used to being in control, fixing the problem, doing things. Breath work, you are concentrating on something. You're physically trying to achieve something. So it can kind of marry up those two goals.
Sorry to interrupt. If you are enjoying this podcast, we would ask you to go and hit the subscribe or the follow button, as we are on a mission to grow this podcast to be as big as it can be and get some amazing guests on here to give you guys even more value. You've got a old morning mobility video, and I used to always finish this. It was like 15 minutes to do it first thing in the morning, and then do like 20 belly breaths with my eyes closed and like lay on the floor flipping starfished out with one hand on my stomach. And literally just like 20 breaths, I would open my eyes and almost feel like I've come out of a bit of a trance. Of just doing 20 belly breaths, or after doing like
20 is quite a lot though.
Yeah, so I do 10 with my right hand on my stomach and then 10 with my left hand. And like that, just like that, the calmness I would start my day in of just doing a bit of movement, a bit of mobility, and then some belly breathing was huge. I've done meditation for about 60 days years ago as well. And that was the only thing I found really interesting there. I remember having like pretty bad arguments with Steph, and it was like amped up. And then I went and meditated and just fell asleep. Like I had meditated to finish and then just fell asleep. And I was like, wow, typically I would have been awake for hours. Mm. But it just shows you how you can get so in tune. Yeah, how in tune with your body, and you can change your state in such a way.
Yeah. Can we talk about how it changes your state? Like, how does it actually work? Mm-hmm. Because it's one of these things that's just banded around, like, oh, it's shown by science.
Yeah.
But I'm somebody who likes to know why by science.
Sure. And I think this is for me, the most important piece of breath science and understanding that everyone should know, because it is the key to going, okay, it changes my state, but how? So we have within our broader nervous system something called the autonomic nervous system, and this governs all of our automatic functioning. So heart rate, digestion, pupil dilation, saliva production, and a few others, and breath. All of those functions are happening automatically all of the time. They're changing, they're fluctuating. And the breath is completely unique as a part of that system, because it's the only part that we can consciously control. So through conscious breath control, we can influence the state of the nervous system. At the highest level, the autonomic nervous system is made up of two key branches. So we have the sympathetic system, which is fight, flight, freeze. It's our stress response. And we have the parasympathetic, which is rest and digest. So through the breath, we actually have a lever through which to create change from one branch to the other. And the best analogy that I found is really viewing the breath either as an accelerator pedal or a brake pedal for the nervous system through how you breathe, the speed at which you breathe, the depth at which you breathe. Is it through the nose or the mouth? And really just changing those subtle things can create that change in state. And within that, where was I going to go with that? I blanked.
Well, what happens to your nervous system when you do put the accelerator on, for example, or the brake pedal on?
So I think given the conversation we've had between us so far, and pretty much I imagine the majority of people listening and just the majority of the population, the brake pedal is to be employed a lot more than the accelerator pedal. So that is about some of the techniques that we talked about, extending the exhale, box breathing, using short holds, slow nasal, you know, gentle breathing. That is going to bring us into that calm, balanced state. The reason why we might go into that accelerator pedal piece and that what we call upregulation and downregulation would be to increase activation. So that might be energy, that might be focus, that might be motivation. We can also use it as well to boost stress resilience. This is where Wim Hof and his side of things really fits into the puzzle. It's cold and it's activating breath work to put that activation on and create positive adaptations in response to controlled stress on our system. But if we are, and I experienced this firsthand when I first got into breathwork, I was like, oh, this Wim Hof guy seems to know what he's talking about. I'm going to do cold showers and activating breathwork every day. I just started having more panic attacks, basically, because I was already, at an 8 out of 10.
Yep.
And so I'm just throwing petrol on the fire and wondering why I feel more anxious, purely because I didn't have an understanding of my own nervous system and also the role that the breath could play.
Yeah.
And
can you just explain what a panic attack feels like? Because I think there's probably a lot of people listening that have maybe had some weird experience and not labelled it a panic attack.
For sure. And I think there are probably some telltale signs and then some probably individual signs as well. So for me, it was I always knew I was heading there, rapid heart rate. My breathing was virtually out of control and tunnel vision was a big one for me, almost kind of like a bit of dissociation where I didn't quite feel I was in my body. Everything was just sort of swirling around me and I had this proper tunnel vision. And then just almost a sense of just impending doom. I was just really felt myself almost like the walls were closing in and everything was coming down on top of me.
Sometimes the visualization people might have is someone like, was it like that for you or was it more of a internal experience?
It always felt very internal and external, but I imagine probably less external than I realized. I think, you know, that experience of really high anxiety is mostly an inside job anyway. You just thoughts are whirring. You can't really control your thoughts. A million thoughts a minute, a million breaths a minute. Heart is pounding. I do know from having had panic attacks in the presence of friends and partners in the past that it is quite obvious, but it's not maybe as obvious as I thought it was. But I do think that rapid breathing is definitely something that people would see if they were paying attention and next to you as well.
Yeah, because my experience has been like very different. For me, I literally couldn't get any breath in. So I wasn't going, like nothing would come. And so I think it's important that people realize that if your nervous system is out of whack, it can show up in many ways. It's not necessarily what we see in the movies. And that doesn't mean if you don't respond like this to stress, doesn't mean that breath work isn't the answer or the helpful thing for you to try.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the pieces of education that I always try and do with my clients is we all have individual, there'll be crossover for sure, but individual early warning signs of stress. And actually, there was an amazing paper that came out a couple of years ago that said that the first physiological signs of a panic attack show up in the body at about 3 hours before the panic attack itself.
Wow.
So if, you know, the way that I described it earlier, I was having a trigger and then I was having a panic attack, that was starting 3 hours before.
Interesting. You know why? Why? Because
we talk about with your emotional eating.
I was thinking, have I ever had a panic attack? And I was like, not really. Maybe the closest I've come to was me and Si and Jim done an event about 5 years ago. And I just was like, oh, it's an event, you know, didn't think too much about it. Got on stage, Jim done an intro, I started doing an intro, and then as soon as I started talking and looking at everyone, just like bump, 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 just hearts going, and I could feel my breath going. I felt like I was going to choke and not be able to say any more words. And it was like horrendous. You know, like afterwards, I was going to people like, did you see me then? Did you? And they were like, no, you looked fine. You seem fine. And then since that event, any time I've done public speaking after this, I've dreaded it. And it's the same thing has kind of happened. I've almost gone into the same state, really uncomfortable, really dreaded it. And then next time, or the last time I remember telling you about this, when we were doing it, I was like, right, I'm going to stop expecting this to happen. I'm going to start saying, I love public speaking. I really want to get, and I just, so instead of pre-framing that I was going to be anxious going into this and almost making my state anxious, is this when you said that, then it like happens hours before, even for me, it probably like days before. Mm. I'm like, I'm anticipating I'm going to feel a certain way. And I just completely flipped it. And it didn't happen.
Yeah.
That was an inside job. That was a mind job in terms of not letting that happen again.
But where I thought you were going with that is, you know, the break the chain exercise that we use with clients.
Yes.
Where there's often behaviours, particularly around eating, that seem to come out of nowhere, and you find yourself in the cupboard and you're like, why am I doing this? And when you break you work back and you break it down, there was something 3 hours ago at work and you've just been ruminating and it's just been building and building. So I'd love to know what these signs are to look out for three hours before.
I think this is really, I often view my work, yes, breath work is the core, but actually I'm inviting people to just gain a better understanding of themselves. Mm-hmm. And the breath is at the core of that. And so this is an exercise in self-observation and self-awareness to go, okay, here I am repeating that cycle that I don't want to repeat. What's gone on for the last 24 hours? What has happened? And actually, what have I been like? And so maybe next time I can reverse engineer it and go, okay, well, the next time I snap at my partner for loading the dishwasher wrong, maybe I'm not in the best state. Because often when we're on these autopilot kind of trains and patterns, we pass it off as that's just the way I am. Mm. That's one of the worst phrases that I can hear come out of somebody's mouth is that's just who I am.
And that just feeds into your lack of self-worth and your identity. And
it's fixed beliefs as well, isn't it?
It's really harmful. Fixed.
Yeah.
It's also a bit of a bullshit excuse.
It's in the kindest way possible. I always try and maintain some compassion here. It's lazy.
It's really because lazy. It's like if you do something really wrong and you just go, oh, I'm sorry. And it's like, well, what are you actually sorry for? Like, you can actually apologize for what you did and why you did it and the state that you're in and make a promise that it's not going to happen again. Because like, that's a real apology, you know, and that's kind of how I see it, because it's, you kind of get justified. I'm just this way. I'm just this person. And then all of a sudden you're just playing into those beliefs that you have, which if you don't want to change, like that's, so be it. Yeah. But you know, if you want to, I think like you're saying, we say all the time to clients, you know, like becoming self-aware is one of the most powerful things that you can do. But you're right, like at the core of it, understanding how your physiology is acting in that time and the breath is such a powerful gateway into understanding that.
100%.
I really want to know what this thing is. Please,
okay.
The study, hours before.
So it'll be subtle signs. So it'll be subtle, but also individual signs. So you might notice on a physiological level, perhaps tingling and feedback from the nervous system. You know, there might be tension. There might be all of these kind of subtle underlying things. Your heart rate slightly elevated, breathing slightly more shallow, slightly quicker. For me, my sort of, I chart my like telltale signs of high stress and burnout particularly closely. Sometimes obviously we miss them because they're quite subtle, but for me, things like irritability, mouth ulcers is always a really big one for me, where I'm like, okay, this is my body going, we haven't rested enough, or we're a little bit overstressed. Mm-hmm. And the earlier I can catch that, the more quickly you can remedy it, right? So you actually have those interventions ready to work backwards from where you found yourself, because when we are working from kind of the unconscious and the subconscious, we can end up in a place that we don't want to be. But the practice is catching them sooner.
Mm. Why mouth ulcers?
I think I don't know enough about the biology of mouth ulcers, but I do know that when we are in a state of chronic stress, our immune response is suppressed. Mm. So actually your body's ability to
just like
fight off.
Right. Cause that's interesting. I have had them before and just being like, oh, have I cut my lip? Or have I cut, you know, and then maybe that isn't the case.
Again, there could be other reasons.
Come out when you're really stressed as well. Mm-hmm. I think the thing for me is, and I'm sure many listeners will feel the same, when you're in that high stress state, life is hectic. It's the time you don't have time to notice what's going on in your body. And that's why it creeps up on you. And it's almost like your body saying, right, you're not listening to me, so stop.
Exactly. It is your body kind of letting you know. Otherwise, you would just carry on. If we could get away with working 18-hour days and training for the remaining 6 hours of the day, we would probably try and do it, right? And the fact that we actually know that we can't sometimes only comes about as a result of the body going, hang on a second. Like, we get these little, not necessarily red flags, but little yellow flags going, you know, I tried warning you once with the mouth ulcers. Now I'm going to try warning you again with something else. And then actually I'm going to give you a virus.
Yeah.
And then you're going to be bedbound and then you're going to have to rest.
Yeah.
And so it's about learning to listen to the whispers before they become shouts, I think.
And I think that's the really powerful thing about a regular practice, whether it's breath work or yoga or even just your mobility practice, is that daily check-in where you have the space to feel like, oh, that feels different today. And then ask the question. Because if you're just going through life, you don't ask the question and then you have to wait till the red flag.
100%. And I think this is something I've noticed in myself in 2024 was I rested as I was able to over Christmas and New Year. I had a really nice kind of bit of downtime and I got back into January and I was like, January feels good. It feels different. It feels slow. It feels calm. It feels spacious. Time is going slowly. I've got so much time in my day. I'm so much more in tune with how I feel. And then the pace of the year has naturally picked up and I'm falling into, I don't have time for this. Everything's moving too quickly. And it's really interesting how the state of your nervous system does actually influence and dictate your entire experience of life, but also your experience of time. And that is, you know, it's one of the most counterintuitive things about the human product in a way and the system, because it is, as you perfectly described, like, the time at which you need it the most, when you are the least likely to find the time for it. When you are your most stressed is when you will say, I have no time. And so this is where we come back around to that idea of being proactive and keeping that daily practice, because then you maintain yourself at a level of 6 out of 10 rather than being 5 out of 10, 9 out of 10, 6 out of 10, 9 out of 10, 8 out of 10, and just really bouncing around. You need to have that nice stable baseline that you can then come and go from. And I think that's really important with the nervous system, is actually understanding that this isn't always, and this is hopefully music to the ears of some people listening who are more type A, is actually this isn't about always being calm, always resting, always, you know, moving slowly. This is actually about this rest to effort ratio, to go, okay, if I'm gonna do more, I have to rest more. You know, the highest performers I know, bar none, are also the best resters I have ever met. They are on and then they are off. And that is how the nervous system should function, is actually we go into stress, we come out of stress. We go into stress, we come out of stress. Otherwise, we end up in this scenario where, and the gym's a great example. The gym is a stressor. It might not make you feel stressed, but it's a stressor on your system. And actually, it's this idea that the state that serves you in the gym, the state that serves you having a podcast conversation, in a meeting, public speaking, isn't the same state that serves you looking after the kids, getting sleep, recovering. Yeah. And so teaching or supporting your nervous system in going in when it's required, if you need that kick up the ass, but also taking the edge off when it's required. Mm. Because otherwise you go morning, we go up, we have our stress, we stay in the stress, we stay in the stress, we stay in the stress. No off switch at any point. We get to the end of the day and just assume that our nervous system will go off.
And we'll just fall asleep.
Yeah.
And most people, I think, listening to this who go, oh, well, you know, I get my sleep. That's just because you're exhausted. That's not good quality sleep. That's just because your system is so knackered from all the stress that it has to get some rest at some point, but it's not proper rest. It's not.
You'll love this. So how I've sold myself to rest a bit more is just from a performance point. Like, if I just keep going, or have just kept going in the past, I get sick more often. I burn myself out, I have low energy, cognition goes down, versus I do find the time more that I ever have to rest. And it's more of a balancing act of, like, by resting more, I can actually do more. That's how I've kind of sold it to myself. So it becomes a very push and pull side of things of, I know when I'm pushing too much, but then I'll equally be planning, like, hey, I'm I'm burning a candle now. I know I'm going to have to dial it back, or I can't do an intense training session tomorrow. Maybe I'll just do an incline walk or something because I want to get some sort of movement in. And it is like a very push and pull, whether I sometimes label it as like abuse, because I'm just abusing the fact that I know how to pull these side of things. But it's also...
It's a balancing act. You are pushing and pulling. You're not just pushing.
Because you would just burn yourself out.
Yeah. So when you said, you know, I'll choose to do an incline walk, I know there's a part of you that might otherwise have been like, why are you being lazy? Get on those split squats.
That's changed. Yeah.
And you're not actually just push anymore.
Yeah.
Which is huge.
Yeah, because otherwise I know now if I did do that super intense workout, it would then affect me cognitively going into the day. And then that doesn't align with me wanting to be performing a day. I mean, if that keeps happening for multiple days, I'm doing something, like, that's a sign for me to be like, hey, you're doing too much. You know what I mean? Something's got to change here.
But do you think everyone has to get to, we talk about this all the time, actually, everyone has to get to that point of like feeling so burnt out to realize it's not bad to step it back? Because I did. You probably did.
I certainly did. Yeah. I come to this question a lot in like healing, in burnout, in so many different realms of, do you have to break before something changes? And I don't know many people. I'd love to meet some people who have made significant changes in their life without needing the stick and just being motivated by the carrot. But I've not seen many examples. Yeah. I do think you have to learn the hard way. And sometimes continue to learn the hard way. This is sort of an upward spiral. It's not kind of a tick box overnight. You make some mistakes, you learn, you reassess, you make a slightly less intense version of the same mistake and you just learn again.
Yeah.
But I do think, interestingly to your point, I resonate with that massively around that. Abuse, I don't think, I get the use of it, but almost when you have that knowledge and that awareness of yourself, that's the power. Because you can go, like, I have really good friends of mine who will be like, I'm going into this next phase fully conscious of the fact that it's going to absolutely knacker me, but then I've got 2 weeks off. And that's fine as long as it's conscious, as long as there's conscious choice there and you're doing it from a place of health.
Yeah. And there's an end state.
Exactly.
And it's not, I'm going into this indefinite job where I'm going to work at that rate forever.
Well, that's it's a great saying. It's like, people aren't afraid of hard work. Or people don't get burnt out from hard work. People get burnt out from hard work with no end in sight. So if people know things are a season, then it's, you know, people can be like, right, well, you know, you've got that intention of like, this is going to be difficult for a month or a week, couple of weeks or whatever that time length is, but you know that it's coming to an end. It's when there's no end in sight is where I think people really hit that sort of like burnout point.
Definitely. And I think that's how we ultimately can helpfully position rest and recovery for people that do like to push and that do like to strive and achieve, because it actually, as you alluded to, it makes you better when you are on. Rather than doing everything at 80% constantly, you are on at 100% and then you're resting and then you're on at 100%. You know, for me, cognition, creativity, all of those important aspects of the work that I do, my capacity to communicate and have thought, like coherent thoughts and express myself, I have to be well balanced and rested for that to happen. Otherwise I'm just a rambling mess.
And when we talk about rest, we're not just talking about sleep. We're talking about like nervous system rest, cognitive rest, emotional rest. So is there anything else that you bring into your life to help balance those things?
Yeah, I think it's this, comes back to the point we're making around kind of making rest productive, but there is an element of that of actually going, make your rest count, rather than expecting it to happen just because you've stopped. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges we face, is people thinking that just because I'm sat on the sofa, just because I am laying down, just because I'm sleeping, I'm recovering. And those things might help, but actually when we are in a more dysregulated kind of chronic stress state, we have to be quite intentional and quite directive with that rest. So it's all the usual suspects again. So it's light intensity movement, walking, getting out in nature, morning sunlight, evening sunlight, getting in tune with your circadian rhythm, things like that. Breath is a fantastic one. Some people call it yoga nidra. Huberman will talk to it as NSDR, non-sleep deep rest, which is incorporating meditative techniques and breath work to take you into that kind of restful but alert state that helps to restore the body and the mind. For me, what else is there?
I think it doesn't have to be rest in the typical sense. And I think that's where people sometimes feel, oh, I don't have time to rest. It can be gardening.
Yeah.
It can be sitting with your kids and doing colouring. It doesn't have to be doing nothing.
Yeah.
And I think if we can break that perception, then it suddenly sounds a lot more achievable.
Absolutely. And I think community and connection is one that often gets overlooked, like healthy, non-productive social engagement.
Yes. Not so networking, missing. Sitting yeah. in your pajamas with your best mate talking absolute shit.
it's almost that allowance for kind of dead time.
Yes.
I think we're so, and I had a great quote that really slapped me around the face the other day, was that don't trade in your 9-to-5 for a 24/7. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I know I've struggled with because I love my work and because I love supporting and helping people, as I'm sure is, you know, the case yeah. for you guys as well. It can become quite hard to actually not think about it. And I, for me, sauna, albeit a kind of mild stressor on the system, is the place where I get the most kind of headspace just to think. Because I might not be thinking about work. I'm just sort of there and it's just thoughts coming and going. And that, I think, in any kind of creative pursuit is so important, just having that like open time for your mind to do what it needs to do without it having to be something that you're going to make notes on or something that you're going to yeah. apply. It just needs, mm-hmm. we just need time to idle time, I yeah. think is probably the best way to put it.
One of the, the counselor had me do this last year. She was trying to get me to calm a bit more, should we say, and she was like running through my day, and I was like, I would get up, I'd cold shower, work out straight away, as soon as I finished working out, start working for a couple of hours, get a shower, have some breakfast, and when I'm having breakfast, I was like, I would watch a podcast or I'd watch a YouTube video to learn more.
Yeah.
And then I'd finish that, I'd like, while I'm washing the dishes, still listening to the thing, go back upstairs, straight back into work, no break. And she was like, right there. Like, you need, like, so the first thing that it was trying to just go for even a 15-minute walk in a day, and when I'm eating, to be doing nothing else but eating, and to just be mindfully eating and to be present. And I literally done this for a couple of days, and I found when I got to the end of the day, I didn't feel exhausted. Like, mm-hmm. typically when I get to the end of the day, I'm like gone. Like you were saying, when I go to bed, I just, yeah. I'm exhausted because I just pass out. And I actually then found that was benefiting my relationship, because I wasn't just like, Steph would come in and maybe want to, and I'm like, I'm done. You know what I mean? I am cognitively out of the, like, I've got no more decisions to make. And she's like, well, we said we make time to speak for this. So, you know, even just bringing in some very
yeah.
little practices like that, just giving myself like 5-10 minutes. She's like, you need to give yourself 5-10 minutes to just let your mind breathe, instead of just going from like one high stress state to like, now I've got to learn in this state and then into this yeah. next state.
I think it's about not constantly consuming, especially in the environment that we're in 2024, you know, consume via your phone, consume via the TV, consume via work. Like, it's all inbound information and there's no time for settling. And there's also not much time for you to like have that inner conversation to make sense of everything that you've consumed.
Yeah.
And I sometimes look at our messages, I'm like, how have you had time to watch 4 podcasts today? Like, you've got a way busier job than me. But I have yeah. a rule, like, I won't go on my phone or listen to podcasts when I walk the dog, because it is one of the few spaces in my day where I'm either not consuming for work or consuming like because for pleasure or on for my child.
Yeah.
And that's not really consumption in the same way, but it's like so demanding. So I think finding a space where at the moment, maybe you do consume, but you don't really need to, is a yeah. really great tip.
Yeah, I've done many times where I've pushed the needle, and I know when I go for a walk, I can't listen to anything. Like, I know I'm pushed, like I actually just need my mind to breathe. And I will actually try and dial back the inputs at that point, because stress is high in other areas. So, but again, I think it's at the core of what you've been saying, it's having that awareness of, well, if I did go and do that, I probably wouldn't even take in half of what I'm listening to, because my mind's racing so yes. fast anyway. And then I'm also, if I do that, I'm not giving myself that time to just breathe and maybe just think about like what is going on and digest yeah. today a little bit.
But yeah. I think there's also that hustle culture that we've referenced. You know, people think, well, I need to listen to that podcast and that's the only time that I've got in my commute or on my dog walk. And so there's this pressure from everywhere to fill every moment of every day, or you feel yeah. like you're not doing enough.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
No doubt. Yeah, I think there's kind of a collective unconscious piece here around that need to achieve and that striving. And striving is this continuous looking outside of ourselves for something that's going to fill the hole inside of us. And if we're still convinced, you know, at the age that we're all at, that doing that thing or achieving that thing is going to make us feel happy, if we're still convinced after so many failed attempts that that is going to happen, then we're just in for another nasty shock. I think there is such a piece here around acceptance, around presence, around, you know, I often ask my question, myself the question, when was the last time I was bored? And I think we have such a bad relationship with boredom.
Yes.
And I ask my clients all the time, you know, how many of the things that you're doing are simply a distraction from the discomfort or the boredom of simply being? And they go, don't ask me that. But it's cultural. This isn't, and I think this is again where we need to cut ourselves some slack. Is going, the odds aren't stacked in our favor. Mm-hmm. Everything is at our fingertips. Everybody else, we're all running the same race ultimately. And we're going, well, if they're listening to that podcast, I need to listen to that podcast. Or if they're, you know, we feel like we're going to lose our edge if we slow down. But ultimately, again, it comes back to an awareness of self, and the regulation within the nervous system helps us tune into that of like, what is the race that I want to be running? Is it, you know, me versus them, or is it just me? And what does...
And not me versus me either. Just me, full stop.
Yeah. And I think I really struggle, and I have been annoying.
Sorry, how yeah, go on. I'm just like, how do you get into that? Because I've always seen it as like a me versus me.
I've told you many times, you're a yogi at heart, you just don't know it.
Yeah.
Is there like a bit of a yoga philosophy thing for you as well? Because a lot of the things you're saying resonate for me.
For sure. I think I wouldn't necessarily say I identify with any one particular kind of school of thought or faith, but I definitely draw from Buddhism, non-dualism. I think probably one of my favorite teachers is a guy called Rupert Spira, who's a non-dualist philosopher who I could sit and listen to for hours, and just listening to him seems to put me into like a state of meditation. And his whole piece is in a moment of discomfort, in a moment of striving, can you simply become aware of being? And it's a very simple, but not very simple question. And it's just coming back to presence, and it's coming back to presence. And to your point, Jamie, I think I really battle and a comfortable and accepting of this battle, reconciling my undeniable and, you know, what I view as a good thing, ambition, with my ambition to not strive and simply be and just be accepting of where I am and who I am, without any of the labels, without any of the shoulds. And those two are conflicting truths.
Well, I don't think they are, if you take that word should. I don't think they are. Because if your ambition and your mission are driven from a place of, like, this is good for the world, this is good for me, I believe in it wholeheartedly, it's not I should do it to impress someone else, I should do it to make more money. It's completely different.
Yeah.
It comes back to that ikigai we were talking about the other day. And when I've had burnout in the past, it's because I was putting everything into something I did not really care about.
Yeah.
Whereas if you are doing the thing and you're pushing yourself, you're not even necessarily pushing yourself, but you're doing all this work and it aligns with your identity and your values and your true self, it doesn't burn you out in the same way. And I think sometimes people just go down that should path, and that's when burnout hits.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think for, even though you've got a real mission and passion for what you're doing, there's other things that you feel like you should do when maybe we could do it for you.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like there's parts of the job still that are shoulds. It's not necessarily what you're doing as a life mission, but looking at everything as like, do I really need to do that?
Yeah.
Might be helpful.
Yeah, I think it's definitely been like a continual journey for me. And I think it's, if I were to say, maybe just more self-acceptance as I've got older and gone further through it. And also understand, I think in the beginning, I had a very, like the actual goal was build a business, make it £1 million business. And then when I got there, I felt nothing. Like it was just empty, hollow nothingness. I had a beer for the sake of having a beer. Numb. And it was because you just get numb to the highs and lows of it all. It was a should goal, yeah. And then it was enjoy the process. And I was like, why don't I enjoy the process? And then it changed to peace. I just want to be at peace. Be at peace with the good days, be at peace with the bad days. And that's been like one that's, then it's kind of now blended into like peace and enjoy the process. Now I'm at peace with the good days, at peace with the bad days, because I'm just like, I expect them to happen. It's a normal part of life. And also, I guess I'm not in a rush as much. I was probably is what I would say. In the past, it was like everything had to be done yesterday. As now, I'm like, the game is long. Like, you do obviously need to have a level of urgency and persistence with the mission that you're going at. But also, I'm just like, the world isn't going to end if things aren't done by next week or end of day. And having that and playing a longer game is definitely, my whole nervous system is quieter, I would say, since having that mindset. But it's, I don't know if that's, I think that should come from maturity, age, delving into it, maybe listening to what other people are saying, listening to myself.
But that me versus me thing as well, it's maybe not always setting such ambitious targets. So that are should targets, because for your workouts now, you don't have to say me versus me. I have to progressively overload every single workout this week.
Yeah.
You can be okay with, I showed up for my workouts this week.
Definitely. Yeah.
And it's taking, how did you make peace with that? Taking that decision-making process or that acceptance into other parts of your life.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I think with the not killing yourself in the workouts is very much more just around, like, I don't need to maintain. I mean, it's like the balance of how that crosses over into the rest of life. Like, Steph's always trying to get me to go to CrossFit. And I just know my competitive self will just always want to just beat everyone and will go 100% or 110%. And then I'm like, but I know that will cognitively negatively affect the business. So I choose not to engage in certain practices that I know would affect work in that sense. So I don't know.
It's self-awareness, isn't it? I also think with, like the me versus me thing, the more you can find happiness and peace in other things that you're doing, the less important certain things seem to be. So, or you have that like burnout moment and you realize like that's not that important. Mm. So for example, last year when I came back from maternity leave, I was like, yeah, sure, I can manage the team on my part-time hours and do all my other job as well, that'll be fine. But it took me to do like 6 weeks of it, be like, actually it's totally not fine. But I couldn't foresee that happening. And probably in the past, what I would have done is say, well, I would just work more hours. Because I couldn't, because I physically had a boundary. I was like, okay, I have to accept that this is not possible. And I think if you have enforced boundaries on you, it's easier to make those decisions because you don't have a choice. And like you're saying, I can't afford for my workouts to affect my output at work. That's like an enforced boundary on you almost. I guess it's finding those boundaries that you can enforce on yourself so that you know where your limits are and when you need to say no to things.
Yeah. I think it's just very much for me. I enjoy building. I am very much more in a state now with work feels a lot more enjoyable for me versus in the past it didn't. There was very many times where it was just forced work for the greater good just because it had to be done. And I think that is the journey of entrepreneurship to an extent. It's like, it's very, very hard and grim at very many times and you kind of have to just push through. But, you know, again, I think just as you get older and wiser and hopefully build stronger systems and foundations and team members, that doesn't always have to be the case.
Yeah. But, and also more self-awareness, which is what everything we're talking about comes back to.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the acceptance piece is the key. I think that's what I see in myself is actually so many times I'm looking to solve this riddle of ultimately what it is to be human. I'm going, okay, well, if it's not ambition, then it's just presence. And I'm looking for either or. And we see that with social media as well. It's polarized, it's black or white, it has to be either this or this. Either you're going to be an entrepreneur or you're going to be a guru. Either you're going to be arrogant or you're going to be an imposter. It has to be one or the other. And actually, it's one of my favorite quotes, which is, wisdom tells me I'm nothing, love tells me I'm everything, and in between those two my life flows. Because I'm going, okay, well, I can be accepting of the days where I don't get it right in my eyes, but even in that, there's an implication that there is a right way to do something. And actually going, yeah, there are parts of me that are ambitious and they'll show up on certain days, and there are parts of me that actually just want to chill and run away into the forest and never build or, you know, create or make money ever again. And those two can coexist.
And you don't have to feel guilty about that bit.
Exactly. I don't have to feel guilty or shame about either side of that. And I can exist in the middle and know that some days striving and reaching and building will feel really, really good. And other days it will feel really, really hard. And that doesn't mean that I'm not cut out for it. It just means that it's a different day. And I think that for me is one of the most challenging parts of this journey is actually the fluctuation and the acceptance of that. As you said, just like there will be good days and bad days, and that is what life is. And if we can accept that, then things become a little bit more easy.
Sorry to interrupt, just a quick ask. If you are enjoying today's episode, then please do give us a follow just to make sure you get every episode and we can keep cutting the BS and helping you hit your goals.
It's such a, like, this is something, again, my mom says, but it's such a cliche thing. I try and coach people on this a little bit when they say it. When people are like, oh, I just want to be happy. Mm. And I'm like, no, you don't. I was like, because if you're happy, like, it's impossible to be happy all the time. So you're instantly creating a deficit for yourself by saying that. Or you're also saying you're not happy now. Versus I feel like just trying to be happy all the time, like, is not as good as, like, being at peace. Because if you're at peace, you can be at peace with the good days, the bad days, the ones in between, and you expect fluctuations, which are normal, as a normal part of the human experience. So I just kind of feel like that's it's an unachievable goal to be in this permanent state of happiness. Versus it's actually where, like, a lot of people feel like they strive towards, instead of just being like, oh, the human experience is, I'm going to feel sad, I'm going to feel happy, I'm going to feel emotional, I'm going to feel anger. You're going to feel all these different things. And isn't there, like, a level of beauty in that to an extent that you get to feel?
Yeah, and I think we've actually become a bit numb to all of those various experiences. And actually part of breath work and tuning into your body and yoga is about allowing all of those experiences to be valid and to be present in your body and not go, oh, sadness, oh, no, oh. Because actually that can then manifest in the body and lead to struggling to breathe and building up stress through a chronic period of time. So I think that you've hit the nail on the head there of allowing that whole variety of experiences to be part of your life. It's probably just a secret to happeness. So we have got a few other questions I know we wanted to talk about. Went down a little bit of a philosophical rabbit hole there. I liked it as well. But there are a few questions that I know some of our listeners wanted us to ask and our researcher wanted us to ask, particularly around this trend at the moment about, like, nasal breathing, mouth breathing. I know we touched on it earlier. What's the deal with that?
Yeah. So I think it nicely takes us back to the real low-hanging fruit with this, which is healthy, optimal, functional breathing is built across these four key pillars, which is nasal, gentle, slow, and expansive. So we're looking for a nose breath that is going to help us to breathe deeply, slowly, gently, and really nourish the nervous system, the body, and the mind. The key piece of the nose versus mouth discussion is an old adage that does the rounds in the breathwork world, which is that noses are for breathing and mouths are for eating. Your nose is literally designed to be breathed through, and your mouth is not. However, with stress, with allergies, and with the Western diet, more and more of us are falling into habitual mouth breathing. And so we need to take back, again, a bit of control and a bit of habituation over nasal breathing. So the nose naturally slows the breath. It's a smaller vessel than the mouth. It filters, humidifies, and basically prepares the air to be received by the lungs in the best possible state. We also naturally get more blood flow to the lower portion of the lungs when we breathe through the nose than we breathe through the mouth. So mouth breathing typically leads to that more shallow chest breathing, whereas nasal breathing helps us breathe more deeply. Really interesting viral video from a friend and colleague of mine, David Jackson, where he put three Q-tips, cotton buds, in his nose, all the way into his nose at three slightly different angles. And the reason that he did this was a very simple but important lesson about breathing, which comes back to what we were saying earlier about vertical breathing. So if you tell someone to breathe deeply through their nose, they look at their nose, whether they realize or not, and they see a vertical instrument. They see a vertical organ. And so they breathe up their nose. They go, and it all comes up again, up into the chest. Your nasal airways and nasal passages are more or less exactly horizontal. So they go back and down. So this is what Jacko was
saying. Actually, that makes total sense. Otherwise, how do they get down there?
Yeah, we're not going sort of up and back and round, are we, when we breathe? So, but it's this, when I saw the video, I've been in this world for 4 or 5 years, I went, oh yeah, of course, but we just don't realize. Yeah. And actually he put the, there's three passages and he put the cotton buds, one into each, and then pulled them out like this on video. It's gross. but everyone in the comments was going, that's made such a difference. And one of the simplest bits of advice to help people breathe both nasally and deeply is to breathe into your face rather than up your nose. And even just trying it now, you can really get a sense of the subtle but important difference it can make, where you actually are breathing into the airways and down rather than trying to breathe up your nose and breathe vertically. Nasal breathing is now in the research, interesting study actually that came out that looked at slow nasal breathing versus slow mouth breathing, because as we've kind of established through this conversation and also in the research, slow breathing is good. Slow breathing versus slow nasal breathing versus slow mouth breathing actually found that nose versus mouth didn't show any differences in terms of the impact on HRV, heart rate variability, and nervous system state. So those two were pretty much the same. However, breathing through the nose gave this long, long list of additional benefits. So things like cognitive function, things like memory consolidation, our capacity to receive and hold on to and learn new information. It helps with efficient gas exchange within the body. And mouth breathing is also incredibly dehydrating. So we lose roughly 40 to 42% more water breathing through the mouth than through the nose. So incredibly dehydrating and really just not good for us. And we can we can fall into illness and allergies when we're breathing through the mouth.
We haven't got that filter.
Exactly. Yeah. So the nose is really...
I don't think many people would know that. That's like a sharp contrast between mouth and nose breathing. Like,
big time.
Huge.
Big time.
But I don't think many people are aware of that at all, of the difference.
Yeah, I think it's something that we're finally starting to wake up to. Mm-hmm. But again, it's like, oh, it's too simple. We're going to cast it aside because it's so just ultimately kind of basic, but taken for granted. Because there's even more kind of data they were looking at. Emotional states as a result of nasal breathing versus mouth breathing, saying there's one study that showed that we had greater access to things like joy when we breathe through the nose, which, you know, we're starting to get down a rabbit hole again there, but actually you're not getting that when you're breathing through the mouth. And so at a very simple entry level point here, it adds so much when we are doing this well, when we are doing this in a kind of optimal state.
And if someone is a mouth breather, what are the things that they can do?
So first port of call, again, I feel like a bit of a broken record at times, but awareness, you have to figure out that you're doing it before you can change it. Then there's the daytime piece. So we're going to go daytime, nighttime. So the daytime piece is functional breathing practice. Consciously, if you are unconsciously breathing in a dysfunctional way, you do have to spend a bit of time consciously breathing in a functional way before your body can relearn functional, unconscious breathing. So... again, 10, 15, 20 minutes a day, and also just throughout the day, noticing your breathing and then always coming back to that nose breath, that deep breath, that slow breath. And so just almost course correcting as you go. Then the nighttime piece is quite important as a part of this puzzle, and it also gets people talking when we start to come onto the topic of mouth taping. And it's been seeing more and more kind of acclaim in mainstream media. The Guardian did a piece on it recently, which is very simply, as the name suggests, kind of a little strip of tape over the lips to move you to nasal breathing during sleep. The big one that gets thrown around with mouth taping is people going, that can't possibly be safe. So we'll come to that first, which is to say, unless you have any significant cardiovascular issues or pre-existing medical conditions, unless you're currently pregnant, or if you are obese or have sleep apnea, severe sleep apnea, then that would count you out of benefiting from mouth tape and just put you into the risk category. If you are generally fit, healthy, and well, and you are a mouth breather during sleep, you've got very little to lose by giving it a try. I had chronic sinus issues for about 3 or 4 years in my early 20s. Also kind of neatly ties around my challenges with my mental health. And I was a mouth breather. And I remember I had a little operation to clear my sinus, my sinuses out. And then I started mouth taping as I got more into this work. And I genuinely couldn't quite believe the difference. It took a little bit of time to get used to it because my body wasn't used to breathing through the nose at night. But once I did, I remember waking up and thinking, oh, this is what it's supposed to feel like to actually wake up feeling like I'd slept, wake up feeling like my head was clear and not foggy. And so there's those two sides to the coin. We have to start with the kind of day-to-day waking piece around just bringing more attention to how you're breathing in certain points, bringing it back to that functional nasal breathing, and then also the nighttime piece that can make quite a big difference, especially if you are falling into mouth breathing at night, because you could spend 16 hours a day breathing well and breathing consciously and functionally, and then go to sleep for 8 hours and take a lot of that good work away if you are breathing through the mouth.
What about the nasal strips as well? Because a lot of people are starting to wear them. Yeah. You're seeing it on social media. It's becoming a lot more of a trend. I know people used to just typically wear them for bed to actually help them nasal breathe a little bit more.
I think for a lot of people, some people, it's become a bit of like a statement.
Right.
But there is a place for it. They're a little bit more simple in the sense that they just help to open up the nasal passages. I, from my rugby days, had deviated septum, a couple of broken noses, and so generally my airways weren't the most readily open, which can make it more challenging. And so if anyone does have any difficulties from a congestion perspective or just from a nasal breathing perspective, if that feels mechanically and sort of physiologically challenging, then they can be a really kind of simple, quick fix as well, both for sleep and during the day.
Mm-hmm. And I know it literally is like a sticking plaster because you literally stick it on your face, but is there something that we should be addressing deeper rather than just sticking things on our face?
For sure. So I very much don't view any of these interventions as kind of long-term fixes. These are short-term things to support as we build towards a kind of more regulated nervous system, more functional breathing pattern, and really working on the bigger picture. But there is a lot of good to be found in supporting yourself in those initial stages. From a mouth taping and mouth breathing perspective, that really will come back to that overall kind of conscious breathing practice. But also we start to get into the realms of the biochemistry of breathing and looking at things like your carbon dioxide tolerance and your capacity to, your sensitivity to CO2 levels in your system, because that is one of the biggest kind of misunderstandings of breathing in general, which is thinking that when you hold your breath, that urge to breathe is coming from a need for more oxygen, when actually it's coming from a rise in CO2. And so there's a little bit around mouth breathing and stress and anxiety that ties back to biochemistry and carbon dioxide as well, that we can start to address and really get into the nitty gritty of breath and sort of respiratory physiology as well.
So if you could give somebody your top three tips, if they're like, oh, I've just listened to this and I've realized I probably have dysfunctional breathing, where would they start?
Practice and commitment to a practice would be the best place. So what would I build out as like a day one practice that is sort of accessible without overloading somebody, but still going to be effective? Typically, I would always start somebody off with a morning and an evening practice, really just starting to ingrain breath as a part of their life. This is ultimately what I'm looking for with people, is this, then it becomes a part of how they think, how they operate, how they go about their day. But having these bookmarked practices throughout the day at whatever point works for an individual is that more proactive consistency piece that's going to help the overall picture. With a lot of my busier clients, because we're all busy, we all don't have the time, I also encourage them to build in what I call breathing breaks. So this might be in between podcast recordings, in between clients, in between Zoom calls, whatever it might be, your 2-3 minutes that you might spend scrolling on social media, you're gonna maybe not scroll, maybe you're still scrolling, but you're slowing your breathing down consciously and intentionally. And so we're going actually from having never thought about our breathing, never practiced it in any way, shape, or form, to building in these kind of standalone pieces where you are sitting and doing the practice, because there's value in that, but also the more interwoven parts of the day and the practice that's actually bringing into your life as more of a whole, where it's, you know, you're on the train, you're in the car, just these subtle things. For me, it's always coming back, and this is something that stayed with me since I first got into breathwork as a practice, is this question of, if I find myself feeling off, whatever off means, anxious, tired, lethargic, overstimulated, just in a bit of a funk, instantly, I do it now, you know, without having to give too much thought, but certainly initially I had to think about it, which was, how am I breathing? And how could I be breathing to create a change in that state? And so it's both using the breath as a bit of a window into my state and then also a way out of that state if I want to create change. So starting with those kind of initial practices.
They're great though. Like that's a lot of cues to create like a new habit. So it's like at the end of a meeting or when I'm on the train or when I'm like for me, when I'm in the car on the way home, they're like great cues. And I think that's a great way entry point to an extent of, I think that's how I've explored breathwork more is I've habit stacked it. So I've done it while I'm driving or I've done it while I'm doing something else. And then the benefits of being like shot, like you said, undeniable to an extent. So then there's been certain points where I'm like, oh, I feel really stressed. I'm going to take a couple of minutes and control my breathing and bring my heart rate down and calm. I mean, it's like, but I would have never done that prior if I had never started doing it, say like in the car while I'm driving and just being aware of it to begin with.
And the great thing with that is you haven't had to find like this new 5 minute window of time.
Yeah.
You already have to drive.
Yeah. Or you're already like on the commute to work or on the train or something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's it. It becomes a bit of a Pandora's box, you know, hopefully, and this is obviously the goal for us here, is someone will listen to this conversation having literally never given a second thought to any breath that they've taken ever. And all of a sudden tomorrow they go, oh, I'm holding my breath or I'm breathing really fast. What did that guy say about how to breathe when I feel like this? And they might come back and listen, or they might find something on YouTube, or they might pick up a book, whatever it might be. And then it's this snowball effect of once you know, it's the old Pringles thing. Once you pop, you don't stop. Like it starts that process of going, okay, there's no real turning back here. And it can be, you know, I met someone at a press event the other day and I got introduced as what I do, which is often the way. And she went, oh, great. Now I'm overthinking how I'm breathing. And there is a little bit of that, of actually, you might start paying quite a lot of attention to it. But in my view, that is better than no attention, because it's like this pendulum swing. We go from one end to the other and then we come back to a slightly more balanced middle ground once we have that enthusiasm and that knowledge and that understanding and that desire to see if it works for you as an individual. So yeah, it does kind of take that first step of listening to a podcast, reading a book. There's an amazing book called Breath by James Nestor, which is kind of the one that everybody typically goes towards as an entry point. And then from there, it grows and it evolves. And I'm also a big kind of advocate of being realistic with this stuff and saying, I would say this stuff can work for 90%+ of people, but you might be in the 5% who actually decide it's not for you. And that's okay too. There'll be other practices and other things. Mm-hmm. But I think breath is so ubiquitous, it's so universal, that I've not met too many people who don't get something from it.
Mm-hmm. And like you just said, oh, what was it that guy said on the podcast yesterday? What do I need to do? Have you got some cues? Because that one you just said about breathing into your face, not up your nose.
Yeah.
Like those visualizations are so helpful when you don't even know you've been breathing wrong. And then you're like, but how do I breathe right? Have you got a few little magic one-liners that can be helpful?
Let's see what I've got in the locker. I think that's a really good one. I think we've talked a lot about nasal, gentle, slow and expansive. There's a slightly... maybe a better one that sticks for people, which is LSD. So nothing to do with taking acid.
I was about to say.
Light, slow and deep. So breathe light, breathe slow, breathe deep. LSD breathing is something that we come back to a lot. Using pressure, and I mean kind of physical pressure, is a really good one. So for a lot of people that might be putting a book or a light weight on their belly when they're doing some breath work. A really good one actually to avoid just being a belly breather and actually breathing expansively kind of laterally into the side ribs and the low back is hands just below side ribs and actually breathing into that space. And actually the reverse kind of pressure helps you actually as a cue.
Could you just demonstrate that for people that are watching?
For sure.
So that you can physically see how your hands are intended to move.
Exactly. So hands forward, thumbs back, just literally below the rib cage. So we're more or less around the diaphragm. And then you start to breathe into that space. And what you'll see is as I breathe deeply, as we've kind of spoken to, it's still quite subtle. It's not like it's not a massive breath. So if I'm taking what I would view as kind of a good breath, it would be. So it's really, really subtle.
But if somebody is following along at home, they will feel their hands move. And that's the difference.
Yeah.
Whereas if you put your hands there normally and you shallow breathe, nothing really happens.
Exactly. You can almost, once you, and again, this is where the simplicity comes as a bit of a benefit, because you put your hands there and you can make yourself do it right and wrong. So you go, okay, I'm going to try and breathe into my chest now and go, and I don't feel my hands move at all. And actually my belly's gone in on the inhale rather than out on the inhale. And then I can do it right and feel the difference. And it's starting to encode. And there's a big piece on this, which is maybe a conversation for another time around how disconnected we are from our bodies. Because actually I could ask someone, are you a belly breather or a chest breather? And they go, I have got a clue.
Yeah.
And then they sit and they breathe and they still don't have a clue. And so there is a big piece here of actually tuning into the body.
That's why biofeedback is so helpful. Massively. As well. The other thing that I find really helpful is just visualizations of, I went to a yoga class actually about a year ago and I've taught yoga for a long time and no one had ever said it like this before. And I thought that is the most effortless way to imagine your breath. So laying on your back and with your hand on your tummy or not, you can visualize, but your hand is helpful. Imagine someone's just gently guiding a ribbon that's tied into your belly button and they're gently pulling this ribbon up. I was like, oh my gosh, I've just accessed a whole new level of breath after all of this time. Even though I knew how to belly breathe, it was with a lot of effort. And just the word like ribbon can make a difference. So I think if you're listening and you're like, yeah, no, this is really doing it for me, like exploring, go on YouTube and go and like see like 5, 6, 7 videos that are explaining how to do it, because it might take one description for you to suddenly click, oh my gosh, this feels so different. So our brains are so powerful when it comes to how our bodies work.
Definitely. And I think as well, from a sort of physiological waking the body back up perspective, things like diaphragmatic massage can be really powerful as well. So take a, how do I do it? Normally inhale, exhale. After the exhale, you sort of dig your fingers.
It feels really wrong.
Up under the rib cage. Well, it feels pretty dodgy if you're not used to it, but you actually like really can get in there and get the neurons and the muscle fibers in the diaphragm firing, because it's a muscle. It's just a sheet of muscle that is responsible for breathing. It's our primary breathing muscle. And so actually it's about waking that up and going, especially if you've got, you know, tight core and a tight thoracic spine, that can make actually your diaphragm quite sticky. And so we're really looking, if you look at a baby, I always come back to talking about how babies breathe, because they don't give a shit about what they look like. They're not sucking their stomach in. They're not worrying about who's looking
at them. We need to talk about that in a second.
That's a good one. But they just breathe so naturally, full power into their belly. And it's just over the course of our lives, you know, we hunch, we get really broken down, we get really stiff throughout. I've still got a really stiff T-spine, but I'm working on it from a breath perspective as well, because it just opens up everything. If you imagine from those models we had at school of the organs in the human body, how much of your lung capacity is at the back? And if you're not getting any remote expansion into the lower back when you're breathing fully, then there's stiffness and tightness there that's keeping you stuck and keeping you kind of tight. And I always say, you know, your breath mirrors your, really your experience of life, in the sense that if you're breathing calmly, expansively, openly, you are open, you are expansive, you are growth, you are everything. Whereas if you're breathing short and shallow and tight, you are restricted, you're tense, you're fearful. And so this is about ultimately expanding within yourself, both sort of physically, but also energetically and metaphorically as well.
And things that you do in your daily life can make a huge difference. So like you were just saying about crouching forwards, when we crouch forwards over our laptops and we roll our shoulders forwards, it's very difficult to breathe properly. And so if you do that for 8 hours a day, you're going to be encouraging that shallow form of breath. So even just checking your workstation, getting a standing desk, getting your screen at the right height, standing differently or sitting differently to work can be a huge factor to your breath, and then that roll-on effect to everything else.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's so important. And this is where it all comes back to being one spoke on the wheel of like health and well-being. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, we're thinking about posture, we're thinking about nutrition, we're thinking about movement, we're thinking about breath. It all feeds into one another. And it's just about what is your entry point. You know, you might start coming into the world of nutrition, and then you'll realize actually, you know, and I have friends and colleagues, and we're constantly referring people across. It's, you know, the nutritionist has realized that this person's got inflammation and a poor diet, and because of their nervous system being under stress and strain. And so we start talking, and we're working on, you know, stress protocols, and all of this stuff is, again, it's like this tapestry of everything that makes us human. And again, a bit of a Pandora's box is once you start.
A good Pandora's box.
Yeah. A very good one.
Because you do, the more you realize, the more you know, the more you don't know. But it's such a great journey and path to go down, because as you start to learn more, you just become, I think coming back to what you said at the core, you become more self-aware. Mm. And the more and more self-aware you can become, the more you can act and make decisions within your best interest and for everyone else's best interest to an extent.
Mm. And you can learn all these tools so that whatever life throws at you, you think, oh, I could try breath work right now, or I could meditate, or I could go for a walk, or I could just stand with my chest open. And you have all these kind of hacks that you can do in a moment to shift your state, which is super cool.
Yes. And I think it's about the kind of acknowledgement that, as you said, different things work for different people and different things work at different times. And it's actually, I always encourage, I started a course, a new course group yesterday of about 40 people. And the one thing that I think people initially don't like to hear, but that I always hammer home is, I want you to figure out your own way here. Like, I will give you everything and you're to figure out what works for you from there, rather than coming here expecting me to have every single answer of how it's going to work for you. And actually, it's about giving that power back to the individual to go, actually, you know, I've woken up this morning, and this ice bath is a great one for this, which is, I don't think everyone at every time will get benefit from ice baths because of how they're showing up on that day, where their nervous system's at, where their mind's at, where their body's at, where their breath's at. And I now, I've been that person who's like, it's an ice bath, it's good for me, I'm going to get in it, to now going, today's not the day for it, because I'm already in an activated, elevated state, and it's just going to add a bit more fuel on the fire. So today I'll give it a miss, but tomorrow might be different. And it's the same for a lot of these practices as well. It's like, what do I need? And tuning in to your needs and tuning into what, from your knowledge, your experience, matches up to what you need in that given moment.
I don't want to go down another rabbit hole, but I feel like this would be a great conversation, because Jamie would be like, no, but you need to be disciplined.
Well, yeah.
But then, because I'm very much the same with everything, with my workouts, like diet, whatever. I'm like, what I feel I need in the moment is what I feel I need in the moment. That's what I'm going to do. But equally, if you don't know your body super well, or you don't know the science to look for, that's not very helpful to a lot of people.
Yeah, I agree, because I bang the discipline drum as well. Like I'm all for it, because I think we have a comfort crisis of people who do, in a lot of cases, let themselves off a little bit too easily and wonder why they're not progressing in the way that they want to.
It's such a fine line. Is what I find, like, that's the being a maturity thing for me. Is in the past it was just push, because that's discipline. And now the balancing act is there a lot more, in the sense of, yeah, like a nice bath or a workout or whatever else. It's like, today is not the day, but I feel like you have to be so in tune with your body to know the difference.
Massively.
Because it's like, right, am I going to get sick if I work out really hard tonight? And should I take an evening off? Or am I being a bit lazy? And it's like, and being aware enough and honest enough with yourself to know which is the right route to go down.
100%.
But I also think it's okay to be lazy. This is the thing about making the peace, because it's okay if you know you're being lazy and you go, yeah, but I need to just take the foot off today. So then it's not even being lazy, right?
There's layers, right? Because I think it's, and it's such a rabbit hole, because you can go, let's take a workout as an example. I'm here debating whether this is going to be a good thing for me or not. If I'm saying no, am I aware enough to see that no as a choice that actually today I just don't fancy it and I'm going to give myself a day off? Is it a no coming from a place of, actually, I know my body well enough and actually I need to rest, even if I might want to? And it's this distinction between wants and needs.
Yeah.
It's like, can I tune into what I need? And actually, that might be my mind telling me, don't get in the ice bath because it's not good for you, when actually I know that it would be good for me, but I'm trying to shirk it and I'm trying to run away from it. And it really gets,
because your mind's very clever and has a great way of talking you out of all the things that you don't want to do in that moment. And that's it. Like, it's a Tuesday, it's 5 p.m., it's dark, you're driving home, you feel a bit tired, you've had a stressful day. It's very easy in that moment to say, maybe I'll just skip the gym tonight, you know, or maybe I just won't go. And, you know, I think it's just, if compoundingly that continues to happen over weeks and months and you keep not showing up, at some point you have to kind of then.
But is it an excuse or is it a reason? Because those were all excuses.
But you make them reasons in your own mind, don't you?
Can.
Yeah, I think it comes back to that piece around just space for all of it.
Yeah.
And going, you know, we bang the drum for self-compassion, but then don't be lazy. You know, it's all of these things. It's like actually self-compassion and acceptance doesn't have to mean complacency. Mm-hmm. And I think it's being able to mesh all of those important things together and going, okay, at its core, can I tune into what I need? And can I also observe what I want in a given moment and make an informed decision based on all of that information and be okay with whatever that decision is that I make? Much easier said than done.
Yeah. So.
And that's what keeps us all busy every day. So you mentioned about a course that you're running. Is that something that's like an ongoing thing people can search for? Or?
Yeah, so I always say my kind of work is split more or less down the middle between in person and online. So I've got what I'm running at the moment is a live version of my 21 Days of Breathwork course, which is an online course that runs through all things breathwork and sort of the full spectrum offering of breathwork. And then I'm actually launching a new course imminently called Breathwork Mastery, which is a 5-week course that I'm doing alongside another breathwork practitioner and friend of mine. And then there's the self-paced version of the 21-day course as well. So there's a few different ways for people to kind of enter into all of this. And all of it is very much geared towards different levels of appetite and experience as to whether you're completely new to this and just getting started, in which case there's free resources and very kind of entry-level resources, or if you want to kind of dive right in at the deep end, then there's stuff to suit that as well.
And where can someone go to find those resources?
Thebreathspace.co.uk is the best place. And Instagram is also where most stuff is living nowadays, which is the_breath_space.
Love it. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on, Jamie. I feel like we could have talked for another 2 hours, probably.
I have no idea how long we've been talking for.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. And thank you so much for making the journey up.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. It's been great.